next case for argument this morning is NewPage Wisconsin System against the United Steelworkers Union. Mr. Fuchs.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Jack Fuchs. I with Thompson Hine. I represent NewPage Wisconsin Systems, Inc. and an NPWSI retiree health plan. They are the plaintiffs and the appellants in a declaratory judgment action that they filed when no action was then pending or has since been pending against them with respect to a dispute involving the change in retiree health benefits, an all too common underlying issue.
What is the current status of the Ohio action?
The current status of the Ohio action is that it is pending on appeal. It is trailing this case. Well, first of all, the district court dismissed for lack of jurisdiction.
Personal jurisdiction.
For lack of personal jurisdiction, the claims of Mr. Clendenning and two other retirees and the United Steelworkers. That is on appeal. It is fully briefed. No briefing date has yet been set.
You mean no argument date?
No argument date. I apologize. I misspoke.
The briefing estimate is from the Sixth Circuit when it's likely to be argued?
My estimate is sometime this summer. I would not have an estimate before then.
Okay.
And it is a situation where the underlying issues are parallel. The legal issue...
No, the underlying issues... Well, maybe the underlying, that's what you mean by underlying. But
the underlying substantive issues...
...isn't going to decide these issues, and we don't have a problem with personal jurisdiction.
That is correct. As a matter of fact, the absence of personal jurisdiction, the presence of personal jurisdiction in this case, in the Western District of Wisconsin, is what in large part distinguishes this.
For an en banc sitting of the Sixth and Seventh Circuits together in order to resolve this case.
Only if you want to resolve the disputes that underlie retiree health issues where the Sixth en banc has rejected. Actually, on the issue before this court today, both the Sixth and Seventh Circuits recognize that in declaratory judgment cases, the well-pleaded complaint rule dictates that jurisdiction is determined by whether federal jurisdiction would exist over the presumed suit by the declaratory judgment defendant. I'm quoting from the GNB battery case that this court decided in 1995. That holding has been adhered to ever since the Supreme Court back in 52 in Wyckoff recognized the general point.
The district court recognized that here, but the district judge said, well, we said something different in Newell.
We did.
Can we succeed if we don't overrule Newell a second time? We've already overruled half of Newell. Is there any way you could succeed without our overruling the other half of Newell?
Actually, yes, Your Honor. Newell never mentions 28 U.S.C. 1331.
Well, that's right, but it also said there was no jurisdiction.
Yes, but it only discussed jurisdiction. There are actually two reasons.
It sounds to me like Newell was just confused. We've already found that Newell was confused in part, but Newell seems to have confused 502A of ERISA with a jurisdictional clause, and we know that the jurisdictional clause in ERISA is not 502A, it's 502E.
Yes, Your Honor.
Then, of course, there's 1331.
Yes, Your Honor.
And maybe it's just a confusion. We try to clear up confusions before they do too much more damage.
I do think that Newell was a confusion, as the court may or may not be aware, but as I suspect Mr. Payne may mention, I represented Newell in the 2008 case, we were arguing that case under...
So at the moment, you're 50% happy because it's been 50% overruled?
It's been, actually, that 50% that was overruled was on the standard and would have actually goes to a less favorable standard for us. So that part probably doesn't get us as far as we'd like.
I'm completely unhappy then.
What I would say, though, Your Honor, is it was a confused case, in part because we were arguing in Newell a situation where there were no retirees in the Northern District of Illinois, and we needed 502E jurisdiction to have nationwide jurisdiction to drag the plaintiffs, the retirees into Illinois. In this case, where over 90.9% of the retirees reside in Wisconsin, we are very pleased with personal jurisdiction under the long-arm statute because 28 U.S.C. 1331 does provide for jurisdiction. 1331 was never mentioned in Newell. You can distinguish by simply saying that 502A3 does not create jurisdiction because it's a cause of action statute provision. 502E is limited to creating jurisdiction for those claims that arise under 502A. This is a case that arises under 28 U.S.C. 2201. That's the cause of action. It's a declaratory judgment. Jurisdiction exists under 28 U.S.C. 1331. Actually, a distinguishing factor never argued in the Newell case, but which we did argue because we recognized that we would confront Newell, is, and I do note that two district courts post-Newell have said that Newell does not apply to the 28 U.S.C. 1331 case, the Boeing case, which settled once it was on appeal. The United Auto Workers agreed to dismiss their appeal in exchange for the withdrawal by Boeing of its motion for fees in the Northern District of Illinois last year. The Trustmark case, which held that there was jurisdiction under 28 U.S.C. 1331 because the action arises under. What I can say to you is, Chief Judge Estabrook, when you asked, is there a way of not overruling, I can tell you that the 11th Circuit did not overrule its decision in Gulf Oil. Rather, it simply clarified, or so it said, that case, Gulf Oil, addressed the 502A3 does not create jurisdiction, and that's all that it really needed to say. This is a situation where the district court committed legal error on the jurisdictional issue because it is clear that the well-pleaded complaint treats the defendant, in this context, the UAW, on the LMRA claim, Mr. Clendenning on the ERISA claim and the LMRA claim, as being the natural plaintiffs, if one would like to say so. They have the ability to pursue a claim under the LMRA. In J.W. Peters, this court held that jurisdiction would exist for such a claim. Similarly, under 28 U.S.C. 1331, jurisdiction would exist for Mr. Clendenning's ERISA claim, inasmuch as the union doesn't have standing one way or the other, wouldn't be in a proper ERISA plaintiff, but Mr. Clendenning as a retiree would be, and in point of fact, has filed the action in Ohio against the parent of the parent of his former employer to obtain the yardman inference. What we would add is, under all precedent in every circuit, 1331 jurisdiction would exist. The 1367 jurisdiction, I think the district court actually also committed a bit of legal error. Although it is true that 1367 very ordinarily applies to when supplemental jurisdiction may be applied only to state law claims. In this context, that's actually a federal claim that is immediately derivative of the LMRA claim. The LMRA claim is, was there a breach of the collective bargaining agreements that were negotiated for the past 30 years? The ERISA claim is, were the collective bargaining agreements treated as ERISA plan documents breached as a result of the change in the retiree health benefits? In that circumstance, the claims are so related to the claims that are within original jurisdiction that supplemental jurisdiction would exist. The district court actually rewrote 1367 to say that if supplemental jurisdiction over all, instead of all other claims, which is how the statute reads, to all state law claims that are so related. It is clearly the situation that supplemental jurisdiction ordinarily applies with respect to state law claims. That's its most common situation. But it's not a circumstance where 1367 is limited by its terms or by any case law only to state law claims. On those grounds, we submit that the court committed legal error. With respect to the exercise of discretion, the district court made very clear that it never actually exercised its discretion to see whether or not it would be appropriate to apply the law of the circuit under which the contracts were all negotiated. That is, the law of the Seventh Circuit, which has very different inferences or presumptions depending upon how commentators construe the law. I appreciate
it. There isn't any law of the Seventh Circuit. There's federal law.
Yes.
We may be right or wrong in our understanding of federal law, but we don't have 13 different laws for 13 circuits.
The court is certainly correct. And in point of fact, ERISA and LMRA are very much national laws. They are, in theory, uniform. There is, however, a split within the circuits. And to the extent that I describe the law of the circuit, I should have restated it as to the controlling precedent of the Seventh Circuit as opposed to the controlling precedent of the Sixth Circuit. The controlling precedent of the Seventh Circuit would be that analysis of law that would inform the negotiations that have taken place with respect to contracts in the Seventh Circuit. The controlling precedent in the Sixth Circuit.
Everywhere. This is national law.
It is.
We may be right, or the Sixth Circuit may be right about its meaning, but there's only one law.
And yet, Your Honor, the inferences that are drawn.
I understand that conflicts among the circuits give problems to people trying to practice law. Right? The Supreme Court may eventually solve this, but there's only one law.
And yes, Your Honor, I agree. My time, I'd like to reserve whatever I may for rebuttal.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Payne.
May it please the Court, I'm William Payne. I represent the appellees, the retirees, and the United Steelworkers. Mr. Fuchs is correct about the way in which Newell Rubbermaid was, quote, overruled in part. It had to do on the issue of the standard of review. And the standard of review applied by Newell Rubbermaid was de novo, and still they found that the choice of the natural plaintiffs should prevail. And what the overruling case said is that in evaluating whether the district court below applied this presumption favoring the natural plaintiff's choice, the standard of review is whether the district court properly exercised wide discretion. They use this wide discretion standard.
Well, first, there has to be jurisdiction, and then the district judge gets to exercise discretion. But the district judge dismissed this suit not in an exercise of discretion, but because the judge believed that the court had no jurisdiction after Newell.
Your Honor,
we need to figure out whether Newell is right. Let me ask you, the judge thought that the court had jurisdiction over the declaratory judgment suit with respect to the collective bargaining agreement under the LMRA.
Yes, Your Honor.
You think that decision was correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Then I don't understand why there's no jurisdiction of the ERISA claim, because the structure of the LMRA is just exactly identical to the structure of ERISA. If you look at Section 301 of the LMRA, it says that courts have jurisdiction to enforce collective bargaining agreements, to enforce them, not to set them aside, not to interpret them favorably, you know, in a particular way. The 301 is an enforcement jurisdiction. And then courts have held that there is nonetheless jurisdiction over a declaratory judgment action under this mirror image approach. Why isn't that equally true with ERISA?
Your Honor, Newell is totally contrary to that.
I know, and Newell is totally contrary to that. The question is, why isn't the approach that's generally used for declaratory judgment suits equally applicable to ERISA? Is there some reason?
Yes, there is, Your Honor. But before I get to it, can I first say that, and I think it's a very important point, that the same analysis the judge used as to the LMRA claim, exercising discretion not to exercise jurisdiction, even if there were jurisdiction over ERISA, would apply so that this court could affirm on the ground.
Let us not, no, we can't affirm a jurisdictional holding on a discretionary ground. Let's just deal with jurisdiction, and you can come later to this discretionary point, which I must say has zero weight now that the district court in Ohio has dismissed the Ohio litigation. So let's just talk about jurisdiction.
Well, Your Honor, ERISA is unique in that it has very narrow causes of action, as Newell pointed out, and it allows and the Supreme Court has said this over and over again in Mertens, and that it's a very narrowly drafted causes of action. And one of the causes of action, the only one that could potentially apply here, is if the employer brings the employer is a fiduciary, and it's trying to bring an action to enforce the terms of the plan. But it is not enforcing the terms of the plan.
I don't think you heard me. So far as I can tell, Section 301 is identical. It creates jurisdiction to enforce collective bargaining agreements. It does not create jurisdiction for declaratory judgment suits seeking to set them aside or annul them or narrow them or anything like that. Nonetheless, courts have held that declaratory judgment actions seeking to interpret collective bargaining agreements are proper under 301.
All three.
Now, I want to know why ERISA is different from that.
Well,
you just pointed out a way in which ERISA is similar.
No, it's different because all 301 says is courts have jurisdiction over disputes concerning collective bargaining agreements. That's all it says.
No, that's not what it says. It says suits for violation of contracts. It does not say suits concerning collective bargaining agreements. That's the point.
And, well, here it's the employer that is trying to allege that there's a violation of the plan. That's the cause of action, 502A3. It just doesn't exist. But as Your Honor said, or as I was raising at the beginning, I think the whole other part of Newell applies here, which is that going back to Temco and the Supreme Court case of Wilton, the courts just simply do not permit the natural plaintiffs to be deprived of their choice of forum. And
as I said, I could certainly understand a district judge saying, I'm going to defer to the Ohio litigation. That's what the judge said with respect to the LMRA. And we have said, when we overruled half of Newell, that appellate review of that decision is deferential.
Yes, Your Honor.
Our problem here is that there is no Ohio litigation at the moment. The district judge has dismissed it for lack of personal jurisdiction.
There is Ohio litigation. It happens to be in the Sixth Circuit. And that's one of the reasons that they're saying Newell is different. Now, let me tell you why the fact that it's in the Sixth Circuit. really makes no difference.
When do you think it's going to be argued in the Sixth Circuit, by the way?
I don't have any disagreement with what Mr. Fuchs said. It has been briefed for a while, and I would expect...
But you haven't checked with their clerk's office to find out when it's likely to be argued?
No, Your Honor. I'm assuming it's probably the summer, as Mr. Fuchs says. But I have to say, this is one difference between Newell. The fact that we now have a decision by a judge, and actually we were, I have to tell you, Your Honor, quite shocked by the opinion of this new judge in Dayton, even in examining the facts that he relied on and cited on in his opinion, and the 150-year history of the company's headquarters actually being in Dayton. We don't see how anybody could conclude that there's no personal jurisdiction. There's no minimum contact.
Well, that's not really what we're talking about here today.
We're not talking about that here, and it doesn't do any good to insult a federal district judge. We know the district judge did conclude this. Lawyers think judges' decisions are erroneous all the time. But saying, no reasonable person can hold this, no. Okay, just saying correct. Federal judges aren't reasonable doesn't get you any traction.
I'm not saying it's unreasonable. I'm saying that he got it wrong. You have the.
But he did so reasonably. I said.
Yeah. All of the officers of this subsidiary corporation are in Dayton, and the stock certificates are in Dayton. The plan, the court held that the plan was based in Dayton. The certificate they file in Wisconsin for this subsidiary corporation says that its principal place of business is in Dayton. How can there be no minimum contact? So anyway, we're confident it's going to be overturned. If the court feels a little queasy about the fact that it's now on appeal, we would have no problem with this court holding off deciding the case.
We're not going to sit here and wait for the case to hatch if the Sixth Circuit is not going to be deciding this until the middle of 2012. Right? If somebody tells me, we actually made inquiries at the clerk's office about when they estimated this case would be argued. They said fall of 2011. The Sixth Circuit's average time to decision is more than 6 months. We're talking sometime in mid-2012 to get this case resolved in the Sixth Circuit. That's a year from now, maybe more. We're not going to just sit here.
And then if it's returned to Judge Crabb and then we have a reversal in the Sixth Circuit, you know, well, I think that could create problems.
Well, that's what makes the whole law business problem.
Well, the other point that Mr. Fuchs makes as to why this case is different than Newell Rubbermaid, which was his other case where he tried to run into court, but he actually got there first that time. In this case, we sued first, and that's another distinguishing feature between this case and Newell Rubbermaid, actually, because who files first is still a factor in this circuit of choosing which case should go forward, and the court could have relied on that too. Mr. Fuchs makes a tremendous amount of argument about the supposed presence of the plants in Wisconsin, and you know why that's a factor. That wasn't what underlied the Newell Rubbermaid opinion, where the plants were. There's a passing reference to the fact that the plant and many of the people were in Michigan in Newell Rubbermaid, and they might in fact be relevant if to a change of venue motion, a motion brought under Section 1404. But I want to emphasize here that the company never made that type of motion in Ohio. And that wasn't what was before Judge Crabb either, that kind of motion. And I think that the facts there are actually wrong and not what was reflected what he said, because it's wrong to suggest that all the plants are in Wisconsin. We alleged in our complaint, which is on the record, that two of the Wisconsin plants had closed by the time we brought the lawsuit. That's paragraph 6 of our amended complaint, docket 19-2. The Kimberly plant the Niagara plant. This isn't on the record, but I've learned within the last few weeks that a third Wisconsin plant, the Whiting plant, has closed down. And then other points on the record show what this company said about its plants. On the docket 19, on page 11, they said, "We're headquartered." This is all you get. You can't find the subsidiary company, NewPage Wisconsin.
You can't get anywhere arguing your Sixth Circuit case in the Seventh Circuit.
Your Honor, I'm not.
Resolve whether the district court in Ohio had personal jurisdiction.
I'm not arguing that.
Being asked to resolve is whether the district court in Wisconsin had subject matter jurisdiction. If we say the answer is yes, this case will go back to the district court, which will then have to decide whether to proceed or to delay pending the outcome of the Ohio case. But we can't decide the personal jurisdiction question in Ohio in this appeal.
Your Honor, I'm not arguing personal jurisdiction now. I am arguing what Mr. Books has said about Newell Rubbermaid. He said it turned on the fact that there were plants and retirees in Michigan. I say it doesn't. There was a passing reference to that. But even if it did, that is a misleading characterization about what was going on here. The company has plants all over the place. It has plants in Michigan.
So I guess I'm just not getting through. I don't understand what is the significance for the existence of subject matter jurisdiction in this case about whether the company has plants all over the place. What conceivable bearing does that have on the subject matter jurisdiction of the district court in the Western District of Wisconsin?
Your Honor, there's subject matter, the no subject matter jurisdiction applied to the one count, ERISA. What I'm talking about now is the exercise of discretion under the
district court never exercised any discretion with respect to the ERISA issue because the court thought it didn't have jurisdiction.
And I believe
you might be able to persuade the district court to exercise discretion.
Well, I believe that
our question is whether it had jurisdiction.
I think Newell Rubbermaid would have to be overruled for this court to hold that there was jurisdiction over the ERISA.
You don't think she has jurisdiction, Judge Crapp?
I don't, because I agree with Newell Rubbermaid.
Oh, wait. That my question is, you do not agree that Judge Crabb had it right in terms of her jurisdictional decision?
No, I believe she was right on the ERISA count that there was no jurisdiction because Newell Rubbermaid is right on point and says there's no jurisdiction.
That should be the end of that, then.
Yeah, but I'm saying that it could be upheld for the same reason she dismissed the LMRA claim. And so that's what I'm addressing, that there...
But I hope you understand that we cannot uphold a decision dismissing for want of jurisdiction on a ground that would provide for different relief. A discretionary withholding of action differs from a jurisdictional dismissal.
I just think that it can be upheld.
It calls for a change in the judgment, and in order to change the judgment, a cross appeal is required. I mean, this is pretty much foundational procedural law.
Your Honor, I'm just referring to what I've known as an ability of a court of appeals to uphold on another alternative ground.
It is not an alternative ground for sustaining the judgment. It is a ground for a different judgment.
Well, I see my time is up, Your Honor.
Mr. Payne, is in your opinion then that if Mr. Fuchs is to prevail here, that we would have to set aside Newell?
Yes, Your Honor. Newell is right on point on the ERISA count. It says there's no jurisdiction. But I was offering the court another way. Judge Easterbrook
doesn't like your other way.
No.
No.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Fuchs?
Your Honor, actually, first of all, I have the only point that I would make is that while I do think Newell was erroneously decided, this case was presented to avoid the problems that Newell posed. This is jurisdiction based on 28 U.S.C. 1331, not on ERISA 29 U.S.C. 1132E for the ERISA claim. This does not require overturning or seeking en banc to require overruling Newell. I think Newell was wrong, but that's something that need not be addressed by this panel. Does the court have any other questions?
No. Thank you very much, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is taken under advisement.